I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. John Updike's Rabbit Saga is now a quintet of novels and decades from the 1950s to the millennial moment at the end of 1999. Since Rabbit himself went to his rest 10 years ago in 1989, you could think of the fifth Rabbit book as his ghost's story. It's also a sort of soap opera of the circle that Rabbit left behind in Brewer, Pennsylvania. It's also John Updike's notebook on America, and nobody notices it all better. Windows 98, The New Las Vegas, the wimpy image of Andrew Jackson, the old Indian killer on the new $20 bill, email humor, Hillary Clinton for the Senate, on top of Monica Gate and the new meanings of oral sex, the Y2K bug, health food and the expanding therapeutic culture, SUVs, Ilian Gonzalez's plight, global warming, DNA evidence, Swedish tooth implants, neuroleptic medications, and Martha Stewart. You could read Rabbit Remembered just for those peculiarly Updikean grace notes on our world, though what really hooks us much deeper is his ear for the life and death urgencies in the ordinary American scene. Connection listeners, we're talking about the late Rabbit this hour, about his wife Janice, remarried, son Nelson, inadequate but recovering, and daughter Annabelle in her first appearance at age 39. Did you know Rabbit in your high school, in your marriage, in your dreams? Make the Rabbit connection with John Updike at 1-800-423-8255 or join us online at theconnection.org. Welcome back, John Updike. You know, I was thinking you could have called this, as Anthony Trollope called one of his novels, The Way We Live Now. It is about everything.
Well, the books are in the present tense, and from Rabbit Run on, they become, I guess, a self-conscious attempt to record what happens to happen in the months of their occurrence. So I wouldn't call myself a social historian in any grand way, but I do pay attention, extra attention, I suppose, to the newspaper and those. In this case, it's like 3 or 4 months, isn't it? It begins in September, ends in early January.
Yeah, I would call you a social historian. The death of JFK Jr., too. Everything's here. It's like your newspaper column in a certain way.
Right. Well, all those. I think we live with this background, and sometimes it almost becomes the foreground of news, and it crackles away, and it's generally bad news. If you notice, tragedies, young man diving into the Vineyard Sound with his wife and sister-in-law, that kind of thing is what we sort of feed on. And what gives us a sense, I guess, of being part of the human race or part of the American race.
Could we talk about Harry? I mean, here he is, more real than ever. He's a presence in the car. He's a curse on the lips of Ronnie Harrison. He's a doll to his granddaughter who barely knew him. He is a live spirit in our times.
Well, right, I wasn't sure as I was writing it, I was really conveying the way in which we do live on in the memories and in the genes of those we leave behind. So yes, Harry haunts this book, and he's meant to be there, almost as an active ghost in a few spots, actually. He almost manifests himself. Mm-hmm. But as to who he is, he began in 59 in my imagination as one of those basketball players, one of those high school athletes whose adult life is anticlimactic and hasn't been anything so good since he was 18, flying down the court. And this is certainly was an American type, and I suspect still exists. It's a youth-admiring culture, and so for men and women alike, the answer is, after youth, what? What's left except trying to struggle to stay young?
He's also the sort of person that kind of bookish and ambitious cosmic kid like yourself would notice in high school, might get to know, might be absorbed as sort of the road not taken or the opportunity not given, and stick with you for a lifetime.
Yeah, my father was an athletic coach, and he was always talking about the naturals that you see when you have that kind of eye go through high school, then I was aware of myself as not quite natural, but I had natural aspirations. I remember I once went to a fortune teller at the Reading fair. And she treated me as though I was one of the jocks, and she told me not to worry, that my grades would start coming up and that I'd probably be all right. So I was sort of flattered by that, that I looked at least like one of the rabbits of the world, though I may not have acted like one of them.
A rabbit imposter, a wannabe rabbit.
A wannabe rabbit,
His son in this book describes him as narcissistically impaired. He tells the daughter that's finally shown up that her father was intuitive but not very empathetic. He was careless and self-centered, but he had his points. People liked being around him. He was upbeat. But then he says, this is not a constructive personality.
No. I think in each of the four rabbit novels, and I don't think of this as a novel, I think of it as a novella, really a kind of a long short story tucked into this book of short stories. But yet, in every one, I think he does something destructive that turns out to be destructive. Certainly the death of the baby in Rabbit Run that could be laid to his door. But then there's another death or two in Rabbit Redux. And so, no, he's not quite a constructive personality, but he thinks positive. he's very American in that. He kind of is a hopeful guy and trying to learn, although he's a slow learner. And not a bad person at all, but...
Who is it in the book, this current book says he wasn't stupid, he just acted stupid.
Yes, his sister says that.
His sister, Aunt Mim, really has the fondest recollection of him. She tells Annabelle what a caring older brother he was and how supportive and non-judgmental that he always was of her, even in the days when she was a hooker. And it's very loving.
Yeah. Yes, she is loving, and you don't remember what's going to happen when you begin a fiction, but I was pleased that Annabelle got to meet Aunt Mim, because Aunt Mim is the closest person now alive from her childish viewpoint, and so Mim is really the place to go if you want to get a little bit of the original rabbit magic.
There are two other things I just want to draw out about Rabbit. Beyond the man, and that is, it seems to me, if I may say, the genius of the book and of your gift is to make the specter of this man, absolute of this man, lives, and not just in his DNA, not just in his presence in the back seat of the car when four people are riding along a highway on Millennial Eve. He's there. He's there certainly as much as Hamlet's father is there as a ghost. He's there in that dream scene. Maybe would you read that?
Be happy to.
Dream scene.
Be happy to read the dream scene. This is Nelson. He's for a moment in his mother's house. One night in early November, Nelson dreams he is lying in his bedroom, which is true. Although it is somehow smaller, like the little front room where Ron's computer sits. He gets out of bed when he hears a distant clicking noise. He goes to the window and sees out in the backyard a tall man in the moonlight. The man is bent over and intent, and a certain sorrow emanates from him in the gray-blue light. His back is turned, and he doesn't turn his head to look up at Nelson, though Nelson dreads that this will happen, a staring white mask in moonlight. Instead, there's just that patient concentration, as if on a task he has been assigned for eternity, the little studied half-swing, a slump-shouldered contemplation of the result, a disconsolate trundling another ball with the face of the club into position at the man's feet, and then another studied swing. Nelson feels indignation that this mournful, tall, middle-aged stranger, in nondescript trousers and a long-sleeved blue-gray shirt, should have wandered into their yard from Joseph Street and be trespassing so brazenly, making that irritating, repeating noise in the middle of the night. Neither in his dream nor when woken by it does Nelson announce to himself who the homeless man is. And we know, I assume, we guess that is Harry practicing chip shots in the afterlife.
There's another dimension of this that just sort of snuck up on Nutter, who defines the book in a way by showing up at Janice's door and saying, you were married to my father. Refers at one point to, she's speaking to Nelson, his son, And she's come back. She wants to talk about my father, she says. Our father. And it just struck me. I mean, you can't say our father, certainly John Updike can't, without conjuring up. I can reread it. There are four very pregnant mentions of our father.
That's very ingenious and good of you, and I think takes the book in the correct spirit. I don't know as I was too much aware of the Lord's Prayer as I was writing it, but it's hard not to be in a way. And the whole concept of fatherhood is all tied in with the Christian God, who is our Father who art in heaven. And Harry Anxum would seem to be in heaven. He's certainly not on earth quite in the course of this book. There isn't too much religion in this book, certainly compared to the first one, where Harry is haunted by God, haunted by the church fronts and the morality of Diamond County back in the Eisenhower era. But I guess insofar as I remain a Christian and haunted by those images, this book too has our Father in it. I saw it as an attempt of Nelson and Annabelle, who've new to each other, and he's in his early 40s and she's about to turn 40, that the one link they have is our Father. And in some sense, Harry is meant to be felt in the book as having brought them together, as having himself in his lifetime failed to discover Annabelle or to get Ruth to admit that Annabelle existed. But now he wants to get them together and wants it to work out, you know, well.
I just beg to differ in the sense that I think there's a lot of religion in this book, not a lot of church going. Annabelle, though, says explicitly she is she's a licensed practical nurse in the care of mostly Alzheimer's patients, and she says in a kind of mental health care. But she talks about, at one point, she says, You can't feel casually about these people. She says, I go on these teams, hospice sends around. Even at the very end, there's something in there. The soul, it seems to me, runs through the whole book. As people talk about death, they worry about death. Nelson has a funny line. He says, it's like a nap, except you don't have to get up and put your shoes back on. But they're worried about that. They're thinking about the other side all the time. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. John Updike is our guest. We're talking about Rabbit Remembered. He calls it a novella. It seems to me a very compressed, big novel in a book titled Licks of Love. 1-800-423-TALK or join us online.org. A lot of other things to say here or to ask you. One of the paradoxes of the book is that both Nelson and Annabelle, both of them involved in care of rather unsympathetic clients in a way, turn out to be better people in a way than Rabbit, and yet are haunted by feeling lesser people.
True. Well put. Harry was large in some way, that is, the largeness of the basketball player. He's 6'3", and he did, you know, in a way, one of the reasons he does damage in the course of the four novels is that he is kind of big and has big appetites and hurts himself, too, with his own appetites, whereas they, of a later generation, a generation with perhaps less expectations than the 50s generation, the 50s generation of which I guess I'm one. We were kind of a greedy bunch. We were handed the post-war world. They have chastened expectations, and they both become what you might call good people. They both become healers, trying to heal the damage their father did.
Do we deny them any credit for that? I mean, is this how do we deal with their sense that, as Harry says, you know, his father was a flop, and yet he had that moment of glory, unlike anything Nelson's ever known?
Well, I think Nelson and Annabelle are more like most people in a way than Harry was. So no, we don't deny them whatever gratifications they can get, but they have, I think, predetermined to lead quiet lives and are reconciled to the fact they're not going to make an immense mark in the world. Whereas Harry wasn't really reconciled. He wasn't reconciled to any of his limits. So he roved and roved on and did these, what you might call antisocial things from time to time as a way of feeding his inner needs. He was very needy, not only sexually, but even his physical. His appetite for food was great, and his appetite, he wished to live forever. Unlike these more modest people, he really was frightened of death as an end to his marvelous self.
There's a charisma, obviously, about Harry, and a grace, even in a literal sort of Christian sense. But one of the mysteries of his following, though, is that he's also is this question of his lovability. Anne Royfe, the writer, said on this program, and she said in an interesting new book called Rabbit with Love and Squalor, that he's one of her great love affairs with Holden Caulfield and a few other more obviously, shall we say, lovable Fitzgerald and Hemingway characters. She had an interesting notion that all Rabbit really lacked was her ministering affection and attention.
Well, that's a thought, and we'll never know what would happen if Anne Royfe had been able to get her attentions on Harry. He is, I think, loved about as much as any human being has a right to be. His wife is loyal in her slightly uninspired, dogged way. His children, Nelson, I mean to say, Nelson looks up to him greatly, doesn't quite know how to get to him. And he has lovers from time to time. Thelma Harrison, we are told in one of the novels, in the last novel, in fact, has had an off-and-on affair with him for 10 years. So I think he gets enough love, and Anne Royfe might have been able to add to the quality of the love, but I think a personality like that really never gets enough love. There's no question of him resting, really, in the amount of affection he's inspiring, because he has a wish to move on to see what else there is.
Do you think of him as lovable? Do you imagine him?
I never thought of that much, no. I loved him enough to write my second novel about him, and to me he was an intelligible and sympathetic embodiment of the male predicament, maybe the human predicament, in fact, the tug between doing your duty and doing right and being decent to the people around you, and on the other hand, the wish to move on, to fulfill yourself, to find the whatever it is that's waiting for you. He's on some kind of a crazy quest. His basketball moments have given him the sense of entitlement, I think they say now. And but the question I was trying to raise in Rabbit Run is not, is he lovable, but is this a good man, or how bad is he, or indeed, what is a good man? So I've never much concerned myself with making him or any other character lovable. I just tried to present them as interesting and as embodying interesting questions about our own lives. As he ages, in the four novels, it would seem to me he does become more lovable, more amusing, a little more grandfatherly, indeed, in the last book than he might have foreseen from the first one.
He's a good grandfather, and apparently he's the younger the child and the older the rabbit, the better it goes. 1-800-423-8255 makes the rabbit connection with the rabbit's creator, John Updike. You were speaking of entitlement and the way people put things now. There's a phrase, Prue, the wife of Nelson, estranged wife of Nelson, is not referred to as a secretary, but as an input organizer. your ear for jargon and your eye for almost everything is all through this book. To change the subject one moment, you write a lot about the therapeutic culture, not only the antidepressants that work and don't work, and schizophrenia and Alzheimer's, but the kinds of people who look after them. What are you telling us about the therapeutic world?
It seems
Prozac Nation, we call it.
It seems to be getting bigger and bigger. People used to just sicken and die, as I remember the phrase was, and they sickened at the end. Medical science can do a lot more for us now, so that a practical nurse like Annabelle finds more and more people who have been preserved into senility and into extreme old age. And as for Nelson, yes, whether it's the stresses of the society or it's a more sensitive society, but we certainly seem to have a large class of people who are not quite functional mentally, and the attempt to make them a little more functional uses up a lot of energy and wealth in the society, and people like Nelson have jobs. It all feels, from a cold-eyed point of view, a little uphill, but undoubtedly it's our nature to be healers and to try to make everybody better. Sure, I think United States now is a rich enough country that we have this luxury of expending a lot of care upon people who 100 years ago or maybe even 50 years ago wouldn't be getting care.
1-800-423-8255, The Rabbit Connection with John Updike. Chuck is on the line.
Yes, good morning.
Welcome, Chuck.
Mr. Updike.
Yes.
I want to thank you for saving my life 40 years ago. I was a crazy mixed-up kid. Was it 1960 Rabbit Run came out?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And I hopped on a train in Boston to go to New York with the firm intention of jumping off the Empire State Building. And I picked up Rabbit Run to read on the train to keep me occupied. And by the time the train ride was over, I decided not to kill myself. Because it was just so beautifully written. And it was just the wonderful, wonderful, exuberant, just highly wrought, totally alive writing. And it just made me feel, wow, the world is filled with really new and exciting, beautiful things. And I decided not to kill myself.
Well, I'm very glad and flattered that you ascribe some of that to Rabbit Run. I remember I was 7 or 8 at the time, and very full of my upbringing in Berks County, PA, and really thought I had something to say, that this world, the world I'd lived through, the world I'd grown up in, mm-hmm. really hadn't been described quite before, that Sinclair Lewis hadn't described it, and Steinbeck and Hemingway and many and others hadn't described it, because it really hadn't been there for them. So, yeah, the book was meant to have. And I found as I was writing it that it had a great, lovely fullness, that there was plenty to say, and I really had to kind of curb my wish to say, and I'm glad that some of that spirit got through to you.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you didn't curb too much, because it was the Dionysian exuberance of the writing, just that you really just went for it. And there was nothing held back or laid back about your attempt to just wring every possible change and you know, really just make the language very, very alive and very, very powerful.
Well,
and, Chuck, I'm thrilled to hear you say it.
It's really saved my life.
There are other writers who read Updike and want to shoot themselves, and maybe do, for all I know, but there's life in that prose, and I'm so glad it worked for you. Can I give you just a little morsel? I mean, there's so many beautiful passages, Chuck, in this new book. But here's just a little fragment of Nelson remembering his father, driving him to a piano lesson or something in his boyhood. Meanwhile, his father's big head was happy with his daydreams, and his hands were light and pale on the steering wheel, with big translucent moons on the nails, usually one hand, while the other absentmindedly patted and stroked the back of his head in a gesture that maybe went back to the days when teenagers had wet ducktails like Sal Mineo or James Dean in the old Rebel movies Nelson could watch on TV. His father had been a rebel of a sort, and a daredevil, but as he got older and tame, he radiated happiness at just the simplest American things. Driving along in an automobile, the radio giving off music, the heater giving off heat, delivering his son somewhere in this urban area that he knew block by block, intersection by intersection, at night, in the underlit ghostliness of the front seat, their two shadows were linked, it seemed, forever by blood. To Nelson, as a child, his own death seemed possible in so perilous a world, but he didn't believe his father would ever die. Chuck, thank you for just the gorgeousness of John Updike's prose. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Rabbit Connection. Melissa is on the line.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. That was beautifully read, and you're just helping me to recall those beautiful hands. And it's interesting. I'm calling because Rabbit had an incredible influence on me, too, a little bit later. I was going through some extreme drama in my own life, and it was a little too much for me. So I took myself away to Nantucket Island in the middle of the winter with nothing but an overnight bag and Rabbit at rest. And it allowed me to survive this really awful time in my life, actually. And I thank you, Mr. Updike.
Well, I thank you for bringing up that incident. You know, when you write fiction, and when you've written a lot of fiction, and when you're accused of writing, having written too much fiction, as I am, you wonder indeed what is the good of these books about made-up characters, and that you took a book of fiction, didn't have to be my fiction, I'm sure, but yeah, it gives us another world, doesn't it, and gives us a chance to get a kind of perspective on our own problems and in a way, reduce them to a scale that we can handle. It's nice.
Two calls in half an hour on the life-saving qualities of John Updike's prose. John, this is wonderful. We're talking about Rabbit Remembered, part five in the now 50-year saga of Harry Ungstrom, the late Harry Ungstrom of Brewer, Pennsylvania. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston University, this is I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Rabbit Connection with the novelist John Updike. Rabbit is back in the ghostly form in the fifth of the Rabbit novels, set in the fall of 1999. It seems like yesterday. Hillary Clinton is running for the Senate. John F. Kennedy Jr. has just died. People are thinking about the Y2K moment. They're having Thanksgiving, getting ready for Christmas in Brewer, Pennsylvania. Janice Ungstrom, Rabbit's widow, is now Janice Harrison in a surprise that begins on the first sentence of the new book. Tell us about Janice, John. She seems to me the least engaged, maybe, of the family members. She's still pretty and attractive. She's not quite forgiven Rabbit, and she's not quite haunted by him either, as other people are.
Well, Janice is moving on,
yep.
And she showed that ability. I did have a certain capacity for adjusting and getting over Harry. Harry was, hardest on her of any of the characters, so she's least warm. But even so, she often thinks about him a bit, thinks about their days together. And you mentioned Janice Harrison, just that phrase to, startle the Rabbit readers out there with the fact that she's managed to marry the one guy in the world that Harry liked least, and that kind of embodied everything that he sort of scorned about being a male. Harry was always a little queasy about his own sexuality in a funny way, and Ronnie rejoiced in his own, and here Janice has done this wicked thing, Harry's ghost
the
might
crude
think.
Plug ugly.
the crude
sort
plug.
Of the basketball bully. The,
right.
The kind of...
And Janice, at any rate, has to be a star now with Harry gone, so I tried to devote a little more time to her inner monologue and her reactions.
Will you read the moment where she's playing bridge or something quite like it with her girls group, and the daughter, Harry's illegitimate daughter, has just appeared on her doorstep, and she goes off to play cards, and she sort of, there's a reverie in which she sort of relives her sexual life in a certain way, starting, not exactly starting with Harry, but back in the 50s.
Yeah, I'll be happy to read that. I dare say my attempt to reconstruct the sexual life of an American woman might not be welcome in all quarters, but I thought I should give it a go. Yeah, she's playing bridge, one of the things middle-aged and more than middle-aged people do. But her mind wanders, and I dare say she's not a very good bridge player. She's thinking now. Things had happened to her since she was a silly freshman adoring him, that is, the youthful Harry Angstrom. He was a senior, I should add, when she was a sophomore. So in high school, they were not dates. They were not an item. She had let her boyfriend in junior year of high school, Jerry Nagel, feel her up and come against her stomach in his father's Packard. And then in senior year, Warren Bixler used to French kiss her and use her hand to jerk himself off after the movies. It was gross, but really helped her understand what happened. And then the summer after graduation, Daddy had rented for a month a Methodist camp meeting cottage in Rehoboth, Delaware, where being in a bathing suit all day and taking a tan deep as a Polynesian's made her feel loose and free. She fell in that summer with a pack of Washington, D.C. kids, raised wild in homes, with their fathers off in the service or the diplomatic corps. They would cruise the boardwalk and Baltimore Avenue all day, and at night head in cars up to Whiskey Beach, where a big pink house had been owned by a DuPont. DuPonts, I should add, are kind of a theme in this whole series, from first to last. They sort of haunt southeastern Pennsylvania. Had been owned by a DuPont, and slit-eyed tall towers stared out to sea as if still watching for submarines. This is after the war. And the college boys would make something called Purple Jesus with grape juice and vodka in galvanized garbage cans. It was the first time in her life she had drunk anything stronger than beer. She had decided as the weeks wore on that it was time, and she let a wide-shouldered boy with a narrow ass from Chevy Chase do it to her, there in the dunes on a sandy blanket, the bonfire just over the shaggy profile of the next dune. She saw the gleam of light on the rubber of the Trojan he put on. That was prudent and considerate of him, but probably made it hurt more than it would have with their natural lubrication. It hurt, but it was done. She was a full woman as of August 1954. His first name was Grant. How horrible that she had forgotten his last name. But he had had to go back with his family the next day or the day after, and she wouldn't have let him do it to her again. She was too sore and scared at herself. "Janice, your bid," Doris was saying.
From Rabbit Remembered, in the voice of the author, John Updike, 1-800-423-8255, joins the Rabbit Connection. Jerry is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Jerry.
Very glad to have a chance to talk to you, Mr. Updike. I've read your books for so many years. I was a scientist in graduate school, and led me to a few thoughts about Rabbit and some of your other aspects of your work. For instance, is Rabbit's name in any sense related to the scientist who bears that name, Angstrom, who did a lot of spectroscopy?
Is in the units?
Yes, I wanted a Swedish name. I wanted him to be something of an oddball ethnically in this very Pennsylvania German county. And Angstrom, thanks to the unit, was one of the few Swedish names I knew. And at the time, I was reading Kierkegaard a fair amount, and so the notion of angst, of fear, of dread, of him being a kind of stream of fear appealed to me also.
Heaven's sake. One of the things that made me think that you might be interested in science, I wonder if you even remember it, but there's a passage that you describe a scientific machine, a scintillation counter, with almost loving detail. It used to be a common way to measure radioactivity, and little vials would move around on an endless chain, and when they got to an elevator, they'd go down, and then they'd disappear, and then they'd come up, and the next one went down. And
I didn't major in science, and I'm kind of an amateur at all this, but I do follow. I'm actually a subscriber and a faithful reader of Scientific American, so... Mm-hmm. So I think it does provide the truths of our time, and that we have to come to grips with the facts that science presents to us, as well as use the technology that they make possible. Mm. So yeah, I kind of keep my eye on science. Maybe I hope that science will have a few more surprises in its bag of the order of the theory of relativity and quantum mechanics.
It probably will. But can you recall seeing a scintillation counter? Did you actually spend some time looking at one?
I think I probably tried to read about them or talk to somebody who had seen one. I'm not sure I have actually seen an assimilation counter.
And then things about the way you carefully structure your plots, things really, they don't seem to happen by accident very much, I believe, and I like the careful connections and reconnections that take place there. I was wondering, does that take a lot of rewriting and finding the loose ends and tying them up, or does it just happen?
You try not to begin until you have at least some kind of structure in your mind already, and then as you go along, certain music develops, certain images are striking, and they, of course, strike the author first, since he's just written them down, and then you try to reuse them, so that this sense you get of a tightly organized plot may be partly illusion. I often don't know exactly what's going to happen in the middle, but certainly I would like to do as you describe. I would like to present the reader with a package that feels organized, and that he finishes with a sense of having been led purposefully through a certain design.
Jerry, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the rabbit and the Updike connection. Maureen is on the line.
Good morning. First of all, Maureen. I'd like to thank Mr. Updike for the hours of pleasure that I've had with his novels. And I wanted to comment, and I wondered if you thought this was an experience shared by many, that when I first met Rabbit in my 20s, I was somewhat revolted by him. I was just too young for him. And when I met him again in my 40s, I would say, I read Rabbit at Rest and just loved it, went back and began with the first novel and went right through them. And then I found Rabbit so lovable that I've gone around trying to convince all my friends that they must read them. And I find many feminists are Rabbit haters. And I wondered what you might say about this. I found that Rabbit was eminently lovable because he becomes every man, but I'm not sure if this is an experience that many young people have, or do you think it's an older person's love, because one has to forgive at that point in life.
It might be that you're old enough to be forgiving now. The first book was written when I myself was young and was meant to be kind of shocking and outrageous, the consequences of his wandering. And yeah, it was trying to show a fairly brutal world of which he is a brutal part. I've been a little puzzled by the feminist and antipathy toward Rabbit and toward me, as if we were the same person. But what can you do? I'm an American male, and I'm trying to present an American male, and there are certain nice things about American males and certain unnice things about them, and the issue of his being lovable or not, which has come up before on this show, wasn't one that was in the forefront of my own mind. I meant to show him as alive and as understandable to a degree, and full of impulses and desires that he himself doesn't fully understand. So in that sense, yes, he's a kind of aggravating puzzle, but I don't mean the books to be puzzles in that sense.
I don't know where we chart, Maureen, thank you, where we chart Anne Royphy on a feminist scale, but it seemed to me she voiced what I've always felt, that there's, for a woman, for a man, for anybody, this huge instruction bravely shared in these books about guys and us and women. I sort of think we're getting over that. But who knows? She adores Rabbit, but she also doesn't hesitate to say that the intelligence in these books is the intelligence of John Updike, and it's really you she adores, and certainly forgives for any trespass on the feminist sensibilities.
It's a puzzle, not puzzle, but it's a challenge to write about a character who's less well educated than you are, because at what point are you foisting off on this character thoughts and illusions that could be only your own? But I have always tried to show him as alert, and certainly he bathes in the radio and television culture that we're all exposed to, and makes his conclusions and watches fashion change, so that without being a literary person, I don't mean to show him as stupid at all. A lot of people who don't read or write books are far from stupid.
1-800-423-8255 makes the rabbit connection. Kim is on the line. Hello, Kim.
Hello. Hi. Thank you. Mr. Updike, I want to thank you for all the wonderful fiction you've been writing for years and years that I've been following. I had a question about the rabbit theme that continues on and on, and you've partially answered it in your last question. I wanted to know a little bit more about how you personally connect with Rabbit as a character, since he's lasted for decades and decades, as opposed to some of your earlier fiction, say in Museums and Women, the Maple stories and so forth, that seem to me, I may be reading way too much into this, that go much deeper into a consciousness than the Rabbit novels do, and yet it's the Rabbit novels that are survived.
It's the Rabbit novels that seem to make the splash and win the prizes. Without the Rabbit novels, I would not have won very many prizes and would be, I think, a much less well-known writer. And it's a bit surprising to me, too, that the other fiction, which is in many ways more sensitive and less hasty and more probing examination of the way we live and think now, but always I found in writing them, sitting down, that Harry Angstrom somehow gives me access to really the land of my youth, to the time of my youth, and to the energies that I felt to be around. You know, you never get impressions quite as potent as your early impressions, and so in that Rabbit has stayed back in Pennsylvania, whereas I have long, long left, he does give me access to the Pennsylvanian within me, and maybe that's why there's a kind of extra energy or an extra appeal here. I have returned, as you noted, to other characters. The Maples return, and of course Henry Beck, the well-known Jewish-American writer, is the subject of three books. So I do reuse some characters, but none as thoroughly as I've reused Rabbit.
1-800-423-8255. I have two questions of my own. I just want to pop at you, John. One, it involves this this undercurrent of conversation about death. Nelson Rabbit's son has an old friend from childhood, Billy Fosnacht, who reappears in this story, and Billy is subject to anxiety attacks and a great sort of haunting in his early 40s about death. And Nelson tells him at one point, Nelson says, by our age, Billy, we should have come to terms with this stuff. And Billy says, have you? And he says, I think so. It's like a nap, only you don't wake up and have to find your shoes. good line.
Yeah.
And he says, believe in God and the afterlife, if that would help. There's some evidence. People who've gone through a near-death experience are absolutely convinced and can hardly wait to get back to the other side. Billy is not persuaded, however, and later on at their lunch, Nelson picks up his own fork, saying, it's a concept the mind isn't constructed to accept, so stop trying to force it. Come on, eat, enjoy. Have I told you, Billy, I've discovered I have a sister? What are we talking about here?
Well,
what are we learning about death?
We're learning that Billy Fosnacht is one of those unfortunate people who is alive, at least momentarily, to the idea that someday he is going to die. Most of us go through life without dwelling upon that because it's a paralyzing thought, a crushing thought. Nelson, who's used to have debates, theological debates with his father, he once told him, Dad, when you're dead, you're dead. Nelson has, from his childhood on, been driven into kind of a anti-afterlife position, which he maintains, and he's added to that the wisdom that a worker in psychotherapy gains, and he tries to give it to... He tries to treat this complaint of Billy's therapeutically. He says, if you want to believe in God in an afterlife, please do. Help yourself if it'll help. Anything that gets you through the night, as Frank Sinatra once said. So that's what he's saying. And, of course, it's not quite enough because you want to have proof. You don't want to believe because it's good to feel you're believing. You really want to know there's something real to believe in.
Which Annabelle seems to believe.
She's a kind of natural believer. At least she's a natural do-gooder and just a very sweet, kind person is how I saw her. She's Rabbit's daughter, but and Ruth's, and these are both kind of tough characters, but she's come out of it, and her upbringing, her rather sheltered upbringing, he's come out of it a very kind, a kind person, a good person.
There's another general question here, and I don't want to give away the story here, but there's a great deal of reconciliation in this book, and more than that, there's a very dramatic healing, a couple of healings, actually, after the revelation of sexual abuse of children. And I wonder what you were telling us about that. I mean, it sort of bursts out of the conversation after a long sort of teasing denial and mention that doesn't fool Nelson. He's suspicious, and we're suspicious that something's going on here. But finally, sort of an autobiographical flashback of sexual abuse comes flashing forward and is somehow resolved. Do you believe it's the way it happens?
Maybe not that quickly or easily, but Nelson is a trained psychotherapist now, and the one thing he can give his sister is to kind of clear up something she's been withholding, and that has to some extent cramped her life. This is my thinking, the author's thinking, which you can't always depend on in a book. And the Freudian theory is that once something is named and brought out into the open, healing begins. So he forces it out in the open in that hectic car ride as the year is changing and as the millennium is changing. And my thought was is that his forcing it out, however brutally, in fact, did her good and made it possible for her to begin to accept male courtship. It's just, you know, an author's schematic notion of how things work, but it seemed to me to be not totally implausible from what I know, and the notion that everything about ourselves, however ashamed we are about it, once it's out in the open, dwindles, becomes less terrible, less crippling, less bothersome.
Well, in fact, in the scene, Nelson's wife, Prue, kind of follows suit. I would have to say this is fascinating. I thought it was the one implausible thing in the novel that Nelson, who's rather a tender character and seems a bit of a follower and a sugarcoater, would have been so brutal in bringing that out into the open. But now you make me think it's perhaps his genius moment that he saw what was going on and lanced it.
Well, here's another thought, Chris. Maybe he's not quite doing it, but that the ghost of his father is speaking through him. He says in this drive, remember he's had this irritating thing of going the wrong way on his own road, and so he's angry, and he feels as though the steering wheel is being taken out of his hand. So in some sense, you might say that it's Rabbit who's forcing this revelation through Nelson, that Rabbit has grabbed hold of the whole car full of kids, in fact, for that moment. But, you know, that's rather fanciful, and I don't demand the reader buy it, but that was sort of in the back of my mind.
Well, he has said a moment before that he felt there was some other presence beyond the four of them in the car. I hadn't quite realized it that way.
You know, in The Wasteland, T.S. Eliot, one of the footnotes of that wonderful poem is that he reports of some expedition, maybe Scott's or Shackleton's, the sensation, the repeated sensation these men near the end kept feeling of there being one other person with them than could be counted. And that's always haunted me, and my little car scene is an attempt to remember that and, you know, do it my way. One more person is in the car than you can count.
You don't mind my taking the point to be that he really is there in the whole book and in life, even in Brewer, Pennsylvania, today as we speak.
Fine. I want you to believe that.
Keep writing it. Thank you so much, John Updike, for this and many, many other books. The book is called Licks of Love, Short Stories, and a Sequel, Rabbit Remembered. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Chris, very much.
You can continue the John Updike conversation on our website at theconnection.org. Thanks for help today from John Hoder, Glenn Alexander, David McMahon, Eric Lockwood, Tim Monroe, Darren Manoogian, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Dan First, Hitesh Hatti, Amy McDonald, Jake Shapiro, Keith Shields, and Will Smith. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.